Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we are glad to have you with us. And we're also very happy to have back here on the program once again, May Barenbaum. She's head of the department. She's not so sure if she's glad to be here, but we're here. We're glad to have her here.
Always glad to be
here. She's head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who specializes in studying insects. And so from time to time, we ask her to come on to the program and to talk about them. And here the idea is, I always say this at the beginning, what we'd like to do is save extermination questions. You know, maybe there is an insect pest that's causing you a problem. Well, that's not what this program is for. It's more for indulging curiosity about insects and how, frankly, cool they are and beautiful they are and interesting in the way that they go about living their lives. So that's what we do. If you have a question about a particular insect, you can give us a call, and if you give us a description the best that you can, she will try and identify it. And then if you have other particular questions, you can ask them, and she will take her best shot. And of course, you can also go to the bookstore and look for some of her books, including Bugs in the System, Buzzwords, A Scientist Muses on Sex, Bugs, and Rock and Roll, the ever-famous 99 Gnats, Nits, and Nibblers, which is, that was your first book, 1989. And there's a new one that will be coming out maybe, I don't know, in about a month or something like that. And maybe when that book comes out, she'll come back and we can talk about that then. But in the meantime, if you're looking for her books, go to the bookstore, go to the library. Ask for them by name. And questions here are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, it's very nice to have you here.
Always a pleasure.
Once again. And we already have some calls here ready to go. So we will not make these folks wait. We'll get right to it. And talk with someone in Champaign on line one right here. Hello.
Hello there.
Yes.
Last week, I was outside of my house and with a friend of mine, and this very big, almost all black bee, at least I thought it was a bee, had three yellow stripes on its back, the back of its, whatever those of you in the entomology refer to, that big part at the back of their body. It definitely wasn't wasp shape. It was just a really big bee with three. And it came. She was a little afraid of it. And it flew over toward me and just sort of looked at me like I was not a flower and then took off and didn't seem to be a bit concerned. And I was wondering, generally speaking, now I don't think we have any Africanized bees around here yet, but generally speaking, bees, if I'm not mistaken, if you ain't a flower and you don't have any nectar on you, they may land on you and look at you and maybe taste you, but if they don't find anything to eat, they'll just go away, and if you leave them alone, they'll leave you alone, and so on and so forth. So I'd like to know if that's generally true and or if there's any exceptions to that you know of around here. And also, I want to know how the bees are doing with colony collapse disorder of late and so forth. So thank you.
Okay.
Well, thanks for the question. What you might have been seeing, if it's really, it looks like a bumblebee, but it's kind of looks like a bumblebee on steroids, it might be a carpenter bee because they tend to be much bigger, less fuzzy, and kind of more generally black in appearance. But there are also bumblebees come in all kinds of different sizes. We got about a dozen species of bumblebees here in central Illinois, and the workers are the ones you usually see. You know, the workers are out in the fields doing the work. But every now and then you'll run across a queen, and they can be much, much larger than the workers. So that's sometimes a little startling to see a really big bee. But the carpenter bees are really hefty. And in general, if it looks like a bee, odds are good that it is a bee, although there's a whole suite of insects that make their living pretending to be bees so that people will be afraid of them. Remarkable how well that works. So among the bee mimics, there are moths, clear-winged moths. So instead of having scales on their wings, because that would sort of give them away as moths, they actually have no scales on their wings, just a few tiny scales on their wings. And otherwise, they look like bees. There are flies that even are fuzzy like bumblebees and buzz like bumblebees and behave like bumblebees, but they're not. But often, if it looks like a bee, it probably is a bee. And you're absolutely right. most of the time, bees couldn't care less about you unless you're a flower. The one exception is those bees that have nests, like bumblebees that, you know, have nests with – bumblebees have a couple of hundred individuals that live in a colony. And, of course, honeybees, it's 20 to 30 to 40,000 individuals. And the one time bees get – I can't say aggressive. It's really defensive. Likely to sting is if they perceive a threat to their home. So it's all defensive. People view it as being aggressive. So if you're out in the field and you see bumblebees, yes, you're right, unless you happen to be standing right next to the nest, in which case you might get stung. But it's really amazing how how people overreact to the threat of a sting. You know, you look at the relative size of a bee and a human. Now, it's true that there's a very small percentage of people who are deathly allergic. There's, you know, one sting can result in anaphylactic shock. But the vast majority of people, it's a, you know, it stings a little, but it's not life-threatening and very avoidable. But people tend to just totally panic. And, of course, panic brings about behavior that is really likely to irritate the bee. So like waving your arms around and, you know, running in circles. And so remaining calm is always good advice. It's interesting, too, and I've said this on the show before, with the social insects like honeybees and bumblebees, the sting is not intended to kill you. The sting is configured to teach you a lesson so that you remember, and in the future, you will avoid bees. So, you know, a dead predator hasn't learned anything. So bees are much better off if they just teach you. So it hurts. And there's even a component in honeybee venom called apamin, which has been shown to improve the transfer of memories from short-term to long-term in the brain. And this is why, at least it's a part of the explanation why most people can remember, like, the first time they were stung by a bee, because that's the plan. The venom is designed not to kill you, but to teach you and have a teachable moment, as our president might say. So that's – but people it maybe works too well because people just really panic. And there's no reason, because the vast majority of bees are not social. They're solitary and will only sting you if you actually grab them in your hand and insult their mother or something, you know, do something really antisocial. But the ones, if you're near the nest, that's another question. That's another issue. In terms of colony collapse disorder, this actually, your WILL television just reran the Nova show Silence of the Bees just earlier this week. So it's very timely to ask for an update. And nationally, colony collapse disorder, this mysterious phenomenon whereby honeybees, you know, workers just disappear. So colonies are left with plenty of pollen and honey, a queen and a number of grubs, babies, and a very small contingent of workers. And there's no dead bodies to account for the other 20,000 to 30,000 missing in action. And so the Apiary Inspectors of America have been monitoring since this phenomenon first manifested itself in fall of 2006. And happily, the percentage of colonies afflicted by this phenomenon is declining. So this past overwintering season, it was down below 30% for the first time in a couple of years. It's not gone, and there's still no clear resolution. We think here at University of Illinois, we think we know what may be going on, but it's still in another couple weeks it will be out, and then maybe I'll come back and I can tell you what our theories are on colony collapse disorder. All right. It's not cell phones. Don't call. It's not cell phones. Honest to gosh.
You have a theory. All right. We'll hear that. May Barenbaum is our guest this morning. She's an entomologist at the U of I. She's, in fact, the head of the Department of Entomology. Every once in a while she's here, we talk about insects. And the lines are full. So we'll take as many questions as we can. 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. The next caller is on a cell phone, and they are on line 4. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. In my backyard, next to my deck and a walkway, there are a group of what I call cicada killers.
Yep.
I believe that that's a colloquial name, probably. But in any event, you know, they're very large, wasp-like looking, interesting insects, and they're very. My German short-haired pointer is very fascinated with them and points them and does everything like that. My question to you is that you know they come back every year and they're interesting to watch and see and but what happens to the cycles of them when there are no cicadas around, and therefore what do they eat during those periods of times of low cicadas or no cicadas, and what happens to them when they if they have a large population of cicadas, do they make more, or do they know that there are more possibilities that they should have more young ones when they go back in the ground and lay their eggs, which I assume that's what they do.
That's exactly what they do. And actually, cicada killers are kind of a lesson in the dangers of being overly specialized, because that's really what they specialize on is cicadas. And that's why you only see them mid to late summer, because that's when the cicadas come out.
Right.
So there's
right.
one generation a year. Then they don't have to worry about what you do when the cicadas aren't around, because they're not around either. They're timed very closely to the life cycle of the annual or dog day cicada. There are other cicadas called periodical cicadas that come out in the spring, but only 13 and 17 years. So that would be a really tough life to be a periodical cicada killer, because if you get your timing wrong, then there's like no food for the babies. So you're exactly right. What they do is they come out and they tend to it's not so much they're coming back to the same homes, but they tend to like the same kind of soil. And you described exactly the kind of place they love. It's a little bit sandy they like, because they dig. And the reason they dig is they dig out these galleries, and they'll lay an egg and then go out, listen for a cicada. And the cicadas, of course, are busy making noise, the males. As Plutarch said, they all have voiceless wives. Happy are the cicadas, for they all have voiceless wives. Plutarch was something of a misogynist, but not a bad entomologist, because he's right. The female cicadas are quiet. Males sing, and that makes them kind of they're taking all the risks for sex. And it's, you know, you talk about the dangers of sex for humans. Well, if you're busy advertising yourself, it makes you a target for cicada killers, if you're a cicada. So that's why sometimes you'll hear these calls just sort of drown out toward the end. Well, that's a cicada killer paralyzing the cicada. And even though cicada killers are the biggest wasps in eastern North America, they are huge, cicadas are still more massive, and it's a real struggle for the cicada killer to haul one of these things down from the tree back to its nest, and it it paralyzes the cicada, which makes that job that much easier, then drags it down, and the still living cicada is paralyzed and provides kind of a, you know, constant source of food for the grubs as they grow underground. I hope our graduate student Rob Mitchell is listening, because he's actually looking for cicada killers. He's doing a study of them. So,
oh, really?
Okay. Yeah. So, if you're listening, Rob, call the station.
I live at 509 West Water Street in Kankakee.
Okay. Oh. Well, he's looking for him.
That's very good.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure enough.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for the
and
program.
You know, this is one of the things that I think often when Phil Nixon has been here, he's an extension entomologist, and he's the guy that we have on who advises about the extermination issue. And many times when he's been here, people have got questions about cicada killers, because they're so big that, you know, talk about people being scared by bees. Well, these things are the biggest, almost the biggest insect you're going to see. I'm sure you'll see dragonflies maybe that are bigger, but they're big. And the thing that he always says is, well, you know, the cicada killers, if one of them is buzzing you, it's checking you out to see, are you
a cicada killer?
And once they figure out that you're not another cicada killer, it's kind of like with the bees, you know. If you're not another cicada killer, they don't care. They're not going to bother you unless you, you know,
run around and flap your hands and hit them on the head.
Yes.
So don't run around.
Exactly. So.
Yeah, they're actually quite territorial. So that's what they're doing, is sort of checking out, making sure you're not invading their territory, you're not after their women. So if you're not after their women, you're in good shape. But I get emails, people want to destroy, you know, how do I get rid of these? Well, my heart says they're totally cool. They are they're among the most interesting insects we have around here. So if you can put up with them, they'll be gone really soon. And, you know, because they're only here when the cicadas are here. So.
All right. Let's talk next with someone in Champaign, and this would be line number two. Hello.
Hi. I got to say, I really found your comment about bee stings being teaching moments and having that specific chemical to kind of help memory really interesting, because one time I got stung on the neck because I used to just feel something on my neck and just assume it was a mosquito and flap at it, and one time it was a bee. And ever since then, I've been much more hesitant to just slap the back of my neck. But that kind of transitions into my next question. I was wondering about mosquitoes. I'm not complaining about this, but I've noticed that this year that for some reason the mosquito bites that I've gotten just haven't itched as much as I remember they have in the past. And I was wondering if I don't know how many different types of mosquitoes we have in the area, but I was wondering if there's one type that produces a bite that itches less than another, and if so, if that one type of mosquito is predominant this summer.
Well, it's a little hard to answer that question because how people respond to mosquito bites is very individualistic. So, you know, kind of depends on your immune system. So some people don't react at all to most bites. Other people are extremely sensitive. And to some degree, how much you react depends on whether you've been exposed before or not to a particular agglomeration of spit. The reason people react to mosquito bites is the mosquitoes not only withdraw blood from you when they bite you, but they pump stuff in. They pump in actually an anesthetizing substance, so you don't actually, you're less aware of having your life blood sucked away from you. They also pump in an anticoagulant material, and that's really important because mosquitoes have really, really fine mouth parts with a very tiny tube that allows blood to come up. If that blood starts to clot, the mosquito can't suck. I know that's probably not heartbreaking for anybody out there who's the other, you know, the receiving end of a mosquito bite, but for them, it means they can't eat. So they pump stuff into you, and that's those proteins that they pump in, these enzymes and the like, are what you react to. Now, that said, there are mosquitoes around here that have that are differentially annoying and pestiferous. For example, the most common in most years is Aedes vexans, and that name should give you a clue. It's an inland floodwater mosquito, and it's the one that, like, 7 days after a big rain, that's what is out there biting. And vexans, it owes its name to the fact that it is extremely annoying and bites around dusk, and it hurts when it bites. And how much you react, again, is you know, reflects your own immune system. But they are very annoying. No reason to think that they aren't abundant this year because we've had plenty of rain. There's no shortage of mosquito species around here. It's not just one. We've got quite a number of them. So I haven't heard in particular that any one species or other is having a bad year. But in general, my own perception is it's not as bad as it's been in past years. It could be that the cooler weather is slowing down their development. Certainly, the floodwater mosquitoes are called that because the females will lay eggs not in the water, but on the mud or around. They don't need to submerge. Their eggs don't need to float in water. What happens is they can go for months and months dry, and then when the waters rise after a rain, that being immersed in water triggers development, and then they start to develop and hatch. So instead of emerging when you know, there's no water around, they are keyed into floods, when rising and falling water. Other mosquitoes and other genera are more standing water mosquitoes. They're the ones you find in bird feeders, for example, or flower pots. Then they're called container breeders, and they're the ones that whose eggs need water all the time and can't withstand this drying and wetting cycle. So, yeah, there's a lot of diversity out there. There's, in fact, there's even mosquitoes that don't suck blood. I don't, by which I don't mean just males. No males eat blood, only females. But there is a genus Toxorhynchites, long name. They're very big mosquitoes. They look scary, but it turns out they are they're carnivores in their immature stages. Immature mosquitoes live in water and eat decaying plant material and the like, except for the Toxorhynchites mosquitoes, which eat other mosquito larvae. So they're actually your good friends.
Ooh, we like those.
Yeah. And if you saw one, you would flee in terror or swat at your neck carefully, because they're big and they look like they could take a pint, you know. But actually, they don't feed on people at all, they're, because they get all the protein they need from eating their fellow mosquitoes in the larval stages.
Something you said about a variable for how itchy a mosquito bite might be, I believe you said was how much a person had been exposed to the mosquito before. Does that mean that a person can theoretically develop a resistance to certain mosquito bites itching over time?
Well, actually, I'm not sure how much work has been done with humans and mosquitoes, but certainly with other biting arthropods, other mammals can develop resistance. With humans, when we have allergies, allergic reactions, usually we have to have an exposure to a particular allergen, to a particular protein that teaches our immune system to respond. So it's usually the allergic response is the second or third or fourth exposure, not the first. So, but whether it there are all kinds of – there's so much individuality associated with the immune system, it's kind of hard to generalize. But certainly there are people that are really, really sensitive and swell up like balloons, and other people who are barely aware of having been bitten. Life is not fair that way, isn't it?
It seems to me that from the mosquitoes that I've experienced this summer, the ones that I have come in contact with in my yard, the thing about them is, whatever kind they are, is they're very small. And so in many cases, you don't even have the chance to swat them because they're so small, you hardly see them or notice them. And then sometime later, some spot starts to itch and you think, okay.
You sure they're mosquitoes? Got me there. They have the mosquito gestalt about them?
Yeah, I kind of think so. Okay. I kind of think so. What would it be? Some likely to be something else?
Well, there's no shortage of other biting flies too. So there's, people generally know what mosquitoes look like. I mean, they have this mosquito-like gestalt about them, and there are other. Often people will mistake some, non-biting flies as like giant. Extraterrestrial type mosquitoes,
yes.
But they're not. They're just, they don't even feed as adults. But they have that long-legged,
the mosquito look.
Yeah,
like,
mosquito look,
exactly, yeah. Right. Okay. We're at midpoint here. Our guest is Mae Barenbaum. She is a professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I. She's a scientist who studies insects and occasionally is here, and that's what we talk about. If you have a question, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's see. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. Next, line one. Hello.
Bella Cocina. Hello.
Yes.
Hello.
Hi, my son is going to listen to me talk on the radio. So I'm telling him to go to the kitchen.
Okay.
Hola, guape. I'm saying hi to him. A couple questions about a couple bugs. We have in our backyard a bunch of sunflowers, and we noticed this year, they may have been there last year too, but this year we noticed them, some bees that sort of at dusk snuggle into the flowers and stay there apparently all night. And then they're quite small, probably a native bee, but they don't look unlike honeybees, except they're small, maybe a third the size. And we've been calling them the snuggle bees because of this. So we were wondering what kind of bee that was, if you knew. And
well,
and do they have a hive somewhere or a home somewhere? Why do they camp out?
Actually, this is the second time in 2 days people have told me about snuggle bees, although used more or less the same description, but
That might have been my
term.
Wife sending you an email.
No, actually, this was someone from California who described exactly the same behavior. And I meant to look it up. There are a number of bees in town that look a lot like honeybees. They're in the same family, but a different subfamily. And they're not social. They don't have an elaborate, nest and with wax cells that they manufacture. But there are, they're called coletids. What's their common name? Plasterer bees, I think.
What kind of bees?
I think their common name is plasterer bee. The scientific name is coletidae. And they're called plasterer bees because the larvae end up being encased in what looks like cellophane underground. The adults make this. And they're not truly social, but they do tend to look like honeybees, and they do aggregate, particularly when they emerge in the spring. So it may well be that during the summer too, and when it gets cold, that they get together. But I can send you to a place where you can almost assuredly find your bees, and that's called the Great Sunflower Project. This is a website that's run by, I think it's San Francisco State University, and it's one of the Help the Bee kind of projects where people from all over the country have sent away for free sunflower seeds, plant the sunflowers, and then photograph the bees that visit the sunflowers over the course of the season. So they're gathering data across the country on bee abundance based on the sunflower as the sort of magnet that draws the bees in. So if there's any place where you'll find snuggle bees and a description, that would be a good place to look.
Well, I believe my wife sent you an email with, and it'd have a picture of those bees.
Oh, really? When was that? I hope I answered.
Sometime in the last week or two.
Oh, okay. I will. I've been out of town, so I'll have to go look and see. Meanwhile, that will give me a good excuse to. I am across the hall from one of the nation's leading bee experts, so I can I can get some help here and make sure I'm identifying. We have North America is actually one of the world's headquarters for bee diversity, something in the order of 5,000 species of bees in North America out of the 17,000 worldwide.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to keep track of.
Wow. I have another question about praying mantises.
Oh, okay.
Related to a question about squash bugs.
That's three different orders here. Okay.
Well, would praying mantises get rid of squash bugs? Or, I mean, they're...
Interesting question.
I go around and pick them off myself, and I rub the eggs off the lid. It's a lot of work getting rid of these bugs. I don't want to spray my garden. And I'm kind of looking for another solution, and I looked at a web page today, said that praying mantises really aren't that great for pest control because they eat...
They eat beneficials, too.
They eat everything, yeah, and they wander off.
Although there's a caveat that most people won't tell you about praying mantises. They don't eat everything. They don't eat things that they don't like, just like kids. And some of the bugs, including possibly the squash bugs. Squash bugs, you said you squash those eggs. They're like bright red, aren't they?
Kind of a bronzy red when they're mature.
Yeah. So... anything in general, anything that's bright colored tends to be distasteful. It's advertising its distastefulness. And some work was done here at the University of Illinois. I don't know if you've ever seen milkweed bugs, which are bright red and black. They make mantids vomit. And mantids can even though they're little tiny brains, they can learn, and they will learn to avoid red and black bugs. And the squash bug is related to... The milkweed bug. They are brightly colored, and there's been some work done on the defensive glands. So they may actually be poisonous to mantids, who may avoid them and eat more tasty beneficials like bees and things.
Bees, yeah. Well, these bugs are gray in color.
Yeah, but immatures are bright colors, right? The baby bugs?
No, the mature ones are gray, a dull gray.
Right, the immature ones. They're kind of brownish, grayish when they're mature.
They're never very bright colored. leaving the egg, they're...
Then you might have a chance at mantids
stink.
Controlling
them. They smell bad.
Yeah. And they do defend themselves, just like the milkweed bugs. Milkweed bugs have a dual defense. They make their own noxious compounds, which you smell, and then they also store poisons from their host plants. And squash bugs, I'm pretty sure there's evidence that they can store or sequester the chemicals that... You ever get like a bad cucumber or a squash that's really bitter tasting?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Those are called, the chemicals that squash family plants make are called cucurbitacins. They're among the bitterest compounds known. We humans can taste one part per billion. And squash bugs may actually have them in their bodies, which may reduce the likelihood that mantids would eat them. So
what are my options for trying to get without chemicals, trying to get rid of these things? Other than what I've been doing.
Other than what you're doing, may be it.
I think commercially there aren't any natural enemies specifically that target squash bugs. They're not economically that much of a problem that people would be selling, for example, parasitic flies and the like. So it may just be...
They destroyed all my pumpkins last year.
Yeah, they're bad news. Well,
I have another question about them, though. One thing I don't understand at all. I mean, they seem to destroy the leaves that they feed on. And I read that they may have some toxins in their...
Yeah, a lot of
it gets injected into the leaf. Why would an animal
kill its
survive evolution that destroyed its food supply like that?
Well, as long as the plant dies after it feeds, that's fine. And as long as the plant isn't in limiting supply, and we actually have changed the landscape for them in that there's not much of a limitation on how many squash plants are around. So. Yeah, there's a lot of the plant-feeding bugs that inject toxins that actually may make plants more soluble, you know, make the proteins more digestible for them, and then they just fly off and leave. So I guess short-term solution would be just what the name suggests, squash bugs.
I'm going to jump in here. I hope the caller will forgive me. I have a number of other people here I want to get to, and we're moving into about our last 15 minutes. Questions are welcome. We'll do as many as we can. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. The guest this morning here on Focus 580 is May Barenbaum. She is head of the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. We'll talk next with someone in Mattoon on line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I've got an identification for you, if you can do.
Hope so.
We have been inundated with a bug my wife and I have never seen before this year. It's come mostly late spring, early summer. They seem to be between 3/4 of an inch and an inch long. Long, narrow insects, definitely insects, tripart body, 6 legs. They seem to have a hard exoskeleton that's deep, deep red, so dark red that, you know, at the right angle it almost looks black. If it had to be a shade, it'd be a brownish red. And they, at the end of their body, and I don't remember what the third part is called, but at the end of the body there are 2 appendages that grow out about 1/4 of an inch that are curved, almost like reverse antenna, or maybe like, you know, it's supposed to look like jaws. But when they're wet, those appendages get straight, so they're not hard. And we almost always find them either in the bathroom or in the kitchen around the sink. Do you have any idea what these critters are?
Well, up until you said that the terminal appendages on the abdomen uncurl, that one I've never heard of, but they sound like earwigs. And earwigs love damp places, and they have these, they're called forceps, that's the technical term,
mm-hmm.
appendages that stick out the tail end,
uh-huh.
and they look like sort of grabby things.
Right.
And they're typically, you can find them in houses wherever there's any lingering bit of dampness, and they feed on all kinds of things. They're very opportunistic. They'll feed on fungi. They'll feed on other arthropods. People don't like them in gardens because they'll nibble on roots and other sorts of things. But The folk wisdom is that they will burrow into your ear and eat your brain. And I am here to tell you that you do not have to worry about them eating your brain. So,
well, that's how they got their name, isn't it?
Well, there's an etymological debate. Most of the evidence suggests that, in fact, the name comes from this mistaken belief that they will crawl into your ear. And every 100 years or so, there's an article in the medical literature about an earwig in an ear, but cockroaches are way more common in people's ears.
Mm-hmm.
But there was one suggestion in a 19th century source that said that the name derives from the fact that the hind wing, which you don't see because it's folded up under a very short forewing that's hardened, like you described, brownish and hardened. If you unfold it, it looks like an ear, and that it's actually a corruption of ear wing. But the Oxford English Dictionary does not buy that description. So, and in fact, an older use is ear and wigga, which is from an old word, Welsh word, I think, meaning bug or creature. So, that's what it sounds like. Sounds like you got earwigs.
Okay, and if they're not going to crawl in and try to feed on my brain, are they any other, besides being a nuisance, any other hassle problem for humans?
No, not to speak of.
A little creepy looking, but
That those pinchers are used in courtship. They're also used actually to help fold up that hind wing so it fits under the. So they'll grab, males or female. Males will battle with each other, and females will actually choose mates based on how big their equipment is. So, it's the life of an earwig.
All righty. I thought earwigs were much smaller, so I'm glad to know that's all this.
There's all kinds of species of earwigs.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you. On to another caller. This is line 3, someone on a cell phone. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have two questions. One is, you mentioned about the bee, when the bee stings, that there are chemicals that that turns it into a teaching moment, so that it improves memory. I was wondering if there's any research, any application to help, like for Alzheimer's or anything like that. Is anybody exploring any of that? And so that's my one question. The second question is totally unrelated. I wondered if you'd heard about when Barack Obama spotted the fly and killed the fly, and then PETA apparently.
Yeah.
Did the catch a bug kind of thing. I wondered if you would comment on that. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay, so the second question was about Obama swatting a fly in PETA.
He was doing an interview with a reporter, and apparently there was a fly in the room, and he deftly swatted the fly. And I guess some people who were concerned about the issue of animal rights got very upset about it.
Well, actually, if you had looked under a microscope at the number of microbes that can infect humans and cause disease that you'll find on the body of a fly, you will realize flies are no friends of ours. In fact, that one of the greatest inventions for human health is the fly swatter. For a long time, people were very cavalier about flies sharing their dinner tables. But you have to remember, flies breed in manure of all kinds of creatures. And manure is teeming with all kinds of unpleasant pathogens, including enteric pathogens of humans. And cholera, typhoid, yaws, all of these things are potentially vectored by flies. So I hope Obama washed his hands after he swatted that fly. And as for PETA, and I'm a vegetarian, I'm a tree hugger and all, but I was really disappointed a few years ago when I went to their website just out of curiosity to see what they had to say about insects. And I found a webpage on how to humanely kill the fleas on your pet. So, they should get their message straight, I guess. So, and what was the first question?
It was she was just wondering. You talked earlier about the fact that in bee venom.
Oh, right. Is anyone using?
Is anybody looking at that as a possible memory improvement aid?
Well, that was originally what was behind the initial study that documented its presence, but not bee venom as much as spider venoms are being investigated for all kinds of. Medicinal purposes. There are amazing mixtures of chemicals that have all kinds of effects on nervous system function. So there are spider venoms being explored to help stroke victims. There are spider venoms being investigated to treat multiple sclerosis and all kinds of other conditions that affect the nervous system. And they are. There's even a company that's devoted to investigating insect venoms for their medicinal purposes because, these have been perfected over millions of years, which is not what, you know, drug companies can afford to invest in. A research program that takes 100 million years is not going to pay off too well. So yeah, there are all kinds of products under investigation and in development.
Okay. And next caller is in Urbana. Line number two right here. Hello.
Is that my turn? Is it
yes.
My turn?
Uh-huh.
A while back, I was out in the yard, and I actually saw a lightning bug. And I started to think about it, and I haven't seen lightning bugs for years. And when we were children, we used to get a jar, and my children did too, get a jar and go out and collect them in the jar. And of course, we let them go. But what happened to lightning bugs?
Well, a lot of people are asking that question. I personally think it was kids with jars. No, what happened, I think, that lightning bugs make that light in a very sophisticated and unusual way. We humans are very bad at generating light energy without wasting other energy. So we take electrical energy and make light energy out of it, except that we lose it in the form of heat. That's why light bulbs are hot when they've been burning. But think about it. Lightning bugs can make light without burning their butts off. So it's a very efficient chemical conversion. They take a chemical and catalyze a reaction and produce light. And drug companies and chemical companies were quite interested in the components that generate light and for years paid kids to collect lightning bugs. And there's no evidence that collecting effort led to a decline. But in general, it's been recognized that lightning bug, firefly is their more proper name, numbers have been in decline. Lots of possible explanations other than over-collecting, including loss of habitat. They are top predators. They feed on – nobody eats them because in order to fly around with your light on, you have to be pretty well protected so that nobody else eats you. And they, in fact, are very distasteful and make some very powerful chemicals that you wouldn't want to eat a lightning bug. Don't eat them. Don't feed them to your geckos either or your lizards because it'll kill them. Even though they're slow and easy to catch because if you ate them, you would be really sick. But again, top predators have a hard time when habitats get degraded and the food chains get abbreviated. They do feed on snails, slugs, and other slow-moving invertebrates. So if they're – and they tend to be more abundant in wet summers. And actually, this summer I've seen more than I've seen in quite a while. So I think it's actually been not a bad year for lightning bugs, but – you're right. They were – nobody's monitored them 20, 30, 40 years ago. But the general impression among the entomological community is, in fact, they have been in decline.
So I haven't seen one since that one night that I saw a couple of them. And
Do you live Do you live in a wooded area?
No, I live in Urbana, but with a lot of trees in Urbana.
Yeah, well, if you go in wooded areas, they are more abundant. So they're not gone yet. So it's good to appreciate them while we have them.
Well, I just was so shocked. I thought when I saw it, I thought, I haven't seen a lightning bug for years. So anyway, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. On again to Belgium, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I might point out with the previous caller also about lightning bugs. Lightning bugs like a lot warmer weather. Mm. And it's been kind of cool, so therefore the lightning bug numbers are down for that reason also. But the question I wanted to talk to you about, Ms. Barenbaum, is, and I know you don't like to talk about hurting animals and stuff, but right above a nice little table we sit out in and watch the weather go by, we have a paper hornet wasp nest, one of those great big ball-shaped ones, mm-hmm. Hello?
Hello,
yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes, yeah. I do.
Well, I know in the wintertime I've seen that they're usually eaten by birds. And I was wondering, is there a safe way a person can kind of preserve that? I mean, obviously I'm going to wait until, you know, the fall and the bugs are pretty much done their thing and stuff, but I'd like to clip it off and maybe coat it in shellac, but obviously I don't want to get stung.
Well, you basically have it down. These, even though they look huge, these nests do not overwinter. Nobody survives. And toward fall, September, and later, their whole social structure breaks down. Basically, they can't survive the winter. And even the queens, which do survive, there's just one queen in each colony, that she usually won't overwinter in the nest because it's too exposed and not well enough insulated. So you don't even really – technically, once the activity ceases, you're probably – at just cutting it down. Make sure there's nobody going in and out for some significant length of time. And you can collect it and just maybe stick it in the freezer to be absolutely sure and preserve it. We have a number in our department, actually, just for demonstration purposes.
Do you shellac them or something to make them a little bit more solid?
No, actually, they're just seem to be pretty resilient and long-lasting. So, we have some that are, we keep them in drawers. They're not out on display. But, they're pretty sturdy.
Oh, good. So all I have to do is get the thing down from 20 feet up.
Yeah, but just make sure nobody's going in and out for some length of time. And then just to be on the safe side, stick it in a freezer so whoever is in there, they're not going to last through freezing.
Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Now we've got about 2-3 minutes left. Try to get at least one more caller. Colfax is next, line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Yes, I have a question about irises and echinacea.
Okay.
I separated my irises, and when I was digging them up, I found all sorts of gray segmented worms that are eating into the rhizome and the bulbs.
Okay, I think there is something. I am cheating now. I'm looking in my garden book, and there's something I called an iris borer that I know about, that I know it exists, and that sounds like you might have an iris borer. And in 1 second, I hope I'm not disillusioning anybody. Here we go. It's a noctuid borer. It's called Macronocutua onusta, and it feeds on irises at the base of the leaves, hollows out the rhizome. How about that?
That's exactly what's happening. It's also killing my echinacea.
Often borers are not too fussy about what they're eating because what they're eating isn't particularly well defended. If you're interested, the iris borer grows up to be a fairly nondescript grayish moth that is not nearly as pretty as your irises.
These irises bloom twice a year, so they're rather special to us.
Yeah.
What can I do to get rid of them?
Call Phil Nixon at the University of Illinois Extension office, because he can tell you what to do with how to get rid of them.
Either that or, whatever is the nearest University of Illinois Extension person to you, I'm sure that they could help you out. But
okay.
We sort of don't do extermination on this show. That's kind of like a special topic. But I'm sure that if you get with the extension folks, whoever is the closest extension person to you, that's a common problem with iris, and I'm sure that they'd tell you would be able to tell you how to take care of it.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't necessarily wanting to kill them. I just want to discourage them a lot.
Well, I think one of the things I think that's really important with iris is that around the base of the plants, you don't want to let old plant material build up. You want to make sure that there's good air circulation down there because I think that the more damp it is and the more that there's dead material there, that the borers like that. So that's the one thing I could tell you. I had a problem myself with some iris, and I eventually over time it just killed the iris, and I gave up on the iris, and I just got rid of it all and put coneflowers there. So. So, and they seem to be doing okay. So, but I'm sure that there are some other treatments, and I'll bet if you got with, as I say, whoever your closest extension person is, they could give you some more advice.
Okay, that sounds wonderful.
All right,
thank
good luck with
very
that.
Very much.
Very good. Let's see, real quick, we'll try to do Gibson City, line 2. Hello.
Yes, hello. I just want to comment on the fireflies, but we live in a wooded area with a creek behind us, even though it's kind of in town. And we had an abundance of fireflies over several weeks, so I do think habitat has a lot to do with it.
Absolutely.
And I'll just hang up and listen. I just want to make that comment, and it was beautiful. I really enjoyed them.
Well, and I was thinking that certainly in our backyard, we have it's pretty woody and shrubby, and have always had lots of fireflies, and it's really nice because it's very dark. So it can be a spectacular display. I don't know how many it is I'm seeing at one time. Hundreds has to be, at least.
And we have a number of different species who flashed species-specific patterns.
And I know that we did have fireflies this year. Maybe it wasn't quite, you know, there are some years that it's just, it's like, as many fireflies as there are stars, it almost seems like. It's really dramatic.
But it is habitat-specific. I mean, it will vary, and woods are good.
Well, we had somebody, and I'm glad we have a minute here, who way back at the beginning, off the air, kind of asked this question about bee bath, like bird bath. You know, are there things that you can do to attract bees, or maybe other things that you might like? And would one of those things be having a water source?
Absolutely, except that they can drown. So a bird bath will not work for bees because they'll get in there. They do collect water. In fact, honeybees have specific individuals whose job it is to collect water droplets. They bring them back to the hive and they use them to air condition. They'll not just as a water source, but you know, it's evaporative cooling, the same concept that we use to air condition our houses. And they do need water, but make sure you have like rocks or something that breaks the surface so that they there's some way for them to get out and they don't just drown, because they are attracted to water and then they can't get out.
So. And if people here who are in and around Champaign-Urbana would like to see some insects, what do you got for them?
Well, we actually have a whole building, a science center devoted to pollination and how to help pollinators, and it's called the Pollinatarium. And it's the road that's just due east of Lincoln Avenue off Windsor. And every weekend we're open from 12 to 4. And we even have a program every Sunday at 2 o'clock. Last week was a lecture on butterflies. This week is Buzz the Giant Talking Bumblebee and ventriloquist Hannah Laskowski. And so we have a program on mimicry. You can go to your website, just Google Pollinatarium. I promise it's the only thing that'll come up. So it's like pollinate, P-O-L-L-I-N-A-T, arium, A-R-I-U-M. And we have exhibits, information pamphlets on how to help bees, what kind of flowers to plant to bring bees. So see you there this weekend, I hope.
Hi. May Barenbaum, she's professor and head of the Department of Entomology at the U of I, occasionally is here on the show. Go out to the bookstore and library and look for some for books. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.